There wasn't much to clean up for the mummies and the kiddies. And we would do that, and then we would have our dinner, and then we'd come back and get to work for the night grand when all the party people would come aboard, the young couples of dates, new and married, and one thing and another. And we would be busier than blazes. And we would be working while we'd unload them. We'd get them in and dock about midnight, and they'd all get off by 12:30 or so. And then we did a real quick cleanup job, just a real rough one. And then we were through for the night. But we went from 6:30 till 1 o'clock, 7 days a week. And we got 17 and a half bucks and room and board.
You got $17 a week, a month?
A week.
A week.
Yeah. Wow.
That was pretty good money.
Oh, in old days, great, good. No problem at all. You know? In fact, I came home with some money. But anyway, later on, you got another job. I worked those machines. You know, where you made those things, and photographs.
Talk about the coin and the making of that coin there.
There was a machine, and it had a great big wheel on it. And back of the wheel was the whole alphabet and other symbols. And you could take the arm of the machine and swing it around and get whatever letter of the alphabet you wanted. And then if you put the quarter in, then the little old aluminum disc came up, you know. And then you punch it, and it'd print that letter on that. And you go right around. And then with a blank space, you could hit, you know, put it and get a space. And you could get, there were symbols. And then when you were all through, there was a button you pushed, and the little disc came out to you. Yeah.
Did you choose the little star in the center and the word lucky?
Pardon?
Did you choose the star in the center and the word lucky?
That was all part of the, that was when the disc came up, that's where it was. Lucky, I put in.
Okay.
So you chose lucky.
Yeah. Oh, I felt lucky. Yeah. Yeah, everything in the ring. Oh, no. Everything, the lucky is part of it. That's all part of it. But I did all of this on my own.
On the outer ring.
Yeah. And here where there's stamps, I pressed the blank, you know.
Can you read what it says?
Pardon?
Can you read what it says?
Yeah, it says Pudgy Herder, Red Wing, Minnesota. Yeah.
Now, what deck was this one on?
Right there by the Coke stand. Not you know.
Is that the first?
Where's that map?
Here's a picture.
It's all right. I got this. I'll get it from here.
Dance.
Yeah. The Coke stand, let's see. That's the first deck. Yeah, the Harbor Master. His the main deck, and here's A deck. Now, the Coke stand would be right over here.
On A deck.
Yeah, on A deck. The bandstand would be right here, and all those little machines were here. Now, when I talk about working in the check stand, that was down here on this deck.
And that was, which deck is that, the main deck?
Yeah, main deck. You'd come on board, and there we were, the check stand was right in front of you. Yeah. And then this is the mezzanine deck. Goes around. You know, and that's where I got the job, and they called me King Kong. You know.
Did you have a lot of free time to just walk around the boat?
Only when I was on the mezzanine deck with the Duke. All the rest of the time I was busy working an assignment. Oh, when I was working in the check room. When the boat was out going, there were two of us working. We didn't need everybody, especially in the afternoon. Then I'd go out and I'd listen to the black crew in the front, you know. And that's when they taught me how I was supposed to behave. I didn't know how to behave, you know.
Did everybody wear the same uniform? All the crew members, or were there...
All the white guys.
So what did the black guys
wear? And the black guys that worked in the upstairs in the restaurant, they did too. But not the deck crew. They just wore this kind of clothes.
Did they wear the same uniform that you did?
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking for the picture of the dance floor. The postcard.
Oh, it's
with all the
wrong place.
Yeah, I wanted to... It was,
yeah, you can see the cook stamps on that one. It's a postcard.
Looking. This is a beautiful postcard.
Yeah. All right, now there's the bandstand. Now, right in over here was the coke stand. Right? And then right in front of that was where all the machines were.
Oh, okay.
And then here you can see the upper level for the mezzanine deck going on.
So you remember listening to the band at night? And
oh, I listened to the band. And they would come down while we were cleaning up, and they would tootle around, and they'd let themselves go. And boy, talk about Dixieland. And we'd be working, you know. Okay, I got a big mop, and I'm doing the dance floor deck, and I'm going back and forth with the mop, and the band is playing. And they got to where they liked this. When the trombone player kept coming to my section of the coke bar, because he was always on the prowl for little girls, single, from passengers. And he knew that if he came to me, he could have free cokes, and, you know. Here's that.
You had all the band members sign the back of a postcard, too.
So on one of them.
Which one was
not
it?
That
the,
one.
The, of the boat.
Of the boat, yeah. Don't seem to have that in
there's
front of me.
Somewhere in there.
It's in the pile.
I think, isn't that right under there? Isn't that it? No.
I'll dig.
No, that's Barbara.
Oh. This band was from New Orleans, is that right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They, in fact, they came aboard at New Orleans. They went up and down. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a guy in the, it teaches in the senior collegium here. He teaches jazz. And I brought this to him, and he recognized a couple of the names.
Is that right?
Wow. Yeah.
Tony Kalak. Kalakahos.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. There's about 12 of them, aren't there?
Yeah, quite a few.
Tony Kalakahos Orchestra, it looks like it says.
They all had sleeping quarters up on the Texas deck in little rooms, cubicles, two to a cubicle. And they could sleep in the morning, and they got their breakfast whenever they woke up and came downstairs, you know. They were big shots on the boat. And the only thing they had to do was make music. They didn't have another job to do on the boat. And they'd wander around and do things. But they got to where they liked us. We were all younger. It works out that most of the white guys that worked the boat were very young. Most of them just high school trained, you know. The black guys were all older. You know, they were like for instance, every day, one of my jobs was to go down with a couple of buckets and go to the ice room. And down in the ice room, they had a crusher, and they'd get chipped up ice, you know, and I'd get a couple of buckets. And there was a guy running that, you know, a black guy. And above his desk, he had a picture of his family taped to the wall. And I remember I asked him about it, and we spent a morning just talking about his family and one thing and another. And he recognized that, okay, this kid is from the north, you know. But the guy had his home in New Orleans. But he told me all about what it was like. And, you know, okay, we'll get home this winter. He says, we'll spend all winter down here in New Orleans. And I'll be home with my family, you know. But all summer long, he was on the boat going.
Were you sorry to see the summer end?
Yeah. This summer up and down the Mississippi, next summer up and down the Ohio, you know.
Were you sorry to see that job end?
In a way, I was kind of eager to get back for football. Anyway, I quit on the way south at Burlington because it was way at the end of August, and I was due home. I had to be home for early football practice. And to get home, I had to hitchhike. Got off in Burlington, Iowa, and then a friend of mine from home met me down in Austin, Minnesota. I told him I'll be in Austin such and such a date, you know. And then he gave me the ride home the rest of the way. Shamo Anderson. Shamo being Neil.
Everybody has a nickname.
Everybody has a nickname.
Before we move on, I'm curious why you saved that uniform. We all had jobs, and we, you know, and we save things, but we don't usually save uniforms.
I know. I don't know why I did. All I know is when Mother died and we were going through her stuff, there it was.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So I grabbed it. I'll put it on.
I'm going to set my camera. It's you.
The SS president. And that's where I learned to wear the army cap.
Yeah. At a jaunty angle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one thing about when they gave it to us, they were nicely pressed. You know, they weren't like this. This is all beat up.
It's very clean. It's very clean anyway.
Oh, it's clean. Just for the boat had their own laundry. You know. And we'd take them off at night and throw them in a pile, in a laundry pile. And they'd draw them back the next morning. What else do you need to know about the boat? It was.
I think that's pretty much it, isn't it?
It was a big rascal.
And it's a casino boat now?
No.
In Chicago?
And I don't think it's the same one either. Okay. It's smaller.
Okay.
And the people that run the river won't allow paddle wheels anymore. No big boilers. Everything is diesel engines
right
now. So when you see the boats going up the river with a paddle working, the water's running the paddle. It's just running free. They got a propeller underneath them run off diesel.
Okay.
But it was fun. It was fun the way the pilots worked those two engines, you know. You get one going forward and one going backward, and you just pivot right in the river, just turn right around. And boy, they could. And then when they got you, they would come downstream to Red Wing from St. Paul, and then they would stop it right in the middle, you know, and it just parked the boat right there, which meant that the wheels were just going slowly in reverse, you know, at a certain rate. And then they had, I don't know how the pilots ran it, but they, and then all of a sudden they'd turn the whole thing around, and then they'd walk it over to the levee, you know, and after they got 10, 15 feet from the levee, they'd throw a line out across to the levee. And all of us kids would grab the little line and pull it, and pretty soon we had the big hawser, you know. And then once we got that there, on one end of the hawser, there's a built-in loop, and we would run it up, throw it over David, and then they'd pull it in.
Were you the only kid in your neighborhood that worked on the president, or were there other friends?
Oh, I was the only one that worked on the president.
Wow.
I was in, yeah.
How much money did you make that summer? Do you remember? You said
$17 a week. I do remember. I shouldn't remember this, but I do. We got down to Dubuque, and Dubuque is right on, in Iowa, right on the Illinois line, where Illinois and Wisconsin and then Iowa. And we're going down there, and all the guys are telling me, boy, you got to get down to East Dubuque. So the minute we docked and got everything squared away in Dubuque, three of us got in a cab and we went over to East Dubuque, and they were sitting there drinking whiskey, you know. I was 16 years old. And then some more of that, as we went down Illinois, we ran into a story on Muscatine. Muscatine is in Illinois, and we docked the boat and we got all cleaned up. And then a bunch of us walked across the levee, and there was a hamburger stand over there, you know, a regular restaurant, but coffee and restaurant. And we went over there, and we were sitting at the counter, and there were four or five of us. One of them was black. And then waiter at the counter came over. Muscatine would be down South Illinois. And he came over and he took the order from all the whites and went around the black. And he wants a hamburger too. Not in this place. And one of the five of us grabbed the guy by the shirt front and pulled him across and said, "He wants a hamburger." And we started a fight. The other people from Muscatine in the joint, we started a fight, and there weren't enough of us, you know, to take care of the whole bunch of them. So we fought all the way across the levee, and we're going up the gangplank, and the rest of the crew woke up. And then they came out and joined us. And then we chased those Muscatine guys all over the place until we had, the levee was clear, the downtown streets were clear. And just about that time, we had to shove off, so we all got back on the boat, you know, and drank.
Did you get into trouble for that?
And then, as the boat is leaving, we untie and we leave. They all come out, and they've all got coal, and they're throwing coal at the boat. And they're breaking all the glass on the They got even with us in a different way.
What did the black guy say about all that?
Now, when we fought him, when we got to the boat and then fought
through the whole experience, what happened? Yeah.
It was all of us, black and white.
Oh, they were fighting too.
Sure.
Did the boat company give you any grief for having a fight?
Oh, we got chewed up for breaking in all the glass. Oh, we got chewed up like that. Don't you ever do anything like that again. Okay, we got chewed up. But they wanted us to work the hours we worked. They couldn't chew us out too long.
What did the black guys say? Did they ever talk to you about their experiences?
Oh,
like after this incident, or
after this incident, there wasn't much. We just ignored it. We just went on. We got up the river to Davenport or wherever it was, and somebody from a glass company came in and replaced all the glass. You know, kind of thing.
They didn't dock your wages.
We didn't have much time to talk to the black people. I heard some of the guys down on the deck crew. They were laughing. They thought it was fun. How often can they get in a fight with white guys? With white guys, against white guys. Yeah, quite different from them, for them, I expect. Quite different from me, too. I grew up a lot. Really, the one thing about black and white on the boat, we were separated. We were not encouraged to mingle it up, but we respected one another. We all said, okay, we're all working, you know, and let it go with that. And that goes for the most of the white guys were from the South. A whole bunch of them, right from, well, there's a gang. One gang of white guys was from New Orleans, and there was another big collection of them from around Memphis. And they spoke to the blacks with a different tone of voice and everything, but, you know, not disrespectful, just the way a southerner would speak to a black, you know, with respect. And I do remember in St. Paul, we got to St. Paul, we would spend 10 days tied to the dock, and we were relieved of all of that cleaning up nonsense. The boat hired people to come in and clean up, you know. All we had to do was be around with the passengers on the boat. And two black guys had gotten a little girl between them, and they were fighting over the little girl, and they were fighting on the dock. And we got over on the dance floor deck and looking over the deck and looking down, and there they are with knives going after each other. And we're just sitting there looking. Some of the black crew finally stopped them, you know. But for a while, they're going after each other, no horsing around. And when I got a kick, the little black girl, she's over on the edge watching. Her eyes just glowing. Boy. Another time, too, we're working. The Duke was a cigar smoker. And, of course, I was a cigarette smoker. I started when I was 14. All the big guys in the neighborhood started all us young kids. And they, you don't dare smoke. So, okay, you take a cigarette and hold it in. You don't dare inhale, so you had to inhale too, you know. So we learned how to smoke early. And Father Daly would tell us, well, if you smoke, it's a sin and one thing and another. Okay, but I knew that everybody, all those adults around church were smoking and come out after Mass, and everybody would light up on the stairs coming down from the church. And our football coach would say, well, if you smoke it, you're not going to be able to run fast. You're not going to be able to do this. You're not going to be able to do that. And I'd sit and I'd look around the room, and there's all the seniors, and they were all smoking. Didn't bother them. But didn't let it bother me much either.
Everybody was aware of the health effects of this. Some people were.
Probably not so much then.
Everybody was.
Yeah. Really?
Everybody was. Just largely ignored. Didn't get carried away. But anyway, we made it. I started smoking when I was 14. I quit when I was 60. The winter after I retired from teaching, Ann and I, we were up in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin. We were out to dinner for her birthday. And I had a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette in it after dinner. I lit it up and I threw the pack away, and I said, that's it now. And then I quit smoking right then. But I figured it, if I was pumping adrenaline, like playing hockey, I'd pump adrenaline like that coaching. I'd be pumping adrenaline like that teaching. I would be pumping adrenaline. I had to have a cigarette. If I taught a class that was particularly good, just where things were just popping and crackling and snapping, I had to get outside and have a cigarette afterwards.
When you were young, though, were there a lot of kids that smoked?
A lot of kids when
yeah.
I grew up?
Yeah.
Most of them. All the ones in our gang. All the ones in our end of town.
But not in front of the parents, of course.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Never in front of adults. Adults would come and everything was under our feet. Mm-hmm. We all did.
You'd go into the store, were you able to buy, or did you send some older kid to buy it?
Steal.
Harry.
Yeah. It was no problem.
Did you want to go on to Buchenwald?
To Korea. Oh, yeah, Buchenwald.
Yeah. Yeah, we wanted to.
That's something you don't have to put in there if you don't want to. You can erase that, we'll steal them.
No, we're putting that in there. You're in trouble now.
Yeah, you were the head of the line.
Yeah. Statute of limitations has run out.
Yeah, we wanted to talk about Buchenwald. You have some.
Oh yeah, Buchenwald. We were working our way through Germany, and after a while in Germany, after we got across the Rhine, there was no more front line. You know, we would go, and wherever we stopped, the German army would be behind us. We were behind them the whole time. And we would stop, and we'd just running around from town to town, securing everything we could, and making ourselves known. And then the German army behind us was surrendering, you know, to troops back there. We didn't know that. We didn't pay attention to that. But we were running like mad, and of course, George Patton made sure we had wheels. We didn't have to walk, you know. And we were going like mad. And we would stop in a village and throw people out of their houses and get in there, and we would sleep in that house that night, you know, and get up the next day and go again. And then one morning we got up, and a whole bunch of new TDs, tank destroyers, were outside. And we said, oh, well, we've got something going, you know. And the word came, saddle up. Well, as soon as we got the word saddle up, we knew, okay, get everything together. We're all, everything goes, you know. And we went out and got on these things, and we started riding, and we were riding right across country. If we hit a road, we'd ride the road a little bit, but then we'd off the road and into the hills and up and down. And I remember we were going up this one kind of a valley with trees on both sides, and it's pasture in the middle, and we're just running right on up it, and we hit the top and the trees quit, and we turned in, And all we could see was this huge, monstrous fence, just, you know, 10, 12 feet high and branched out on the top. And several layers, you know, there was this fence and then a fence and then a fence, you know. And a lot of barbed wire, a lot of barbed wire. And we stopped, and the TDs came up and they formed a line looking at this fence, going around the corner because that was the back end. And somehow the word, now, being a private, I'm riding, I don't follow, you know, I follow orders, yes, but I don't issue them. I have no idea what we're doing or what. But then we just took off to that fence, and boy, you should have seen those of us riding, scrambling to get behind the turret, when you know, all that barbed wire snapping and crackling. And I swear, to this day, I will swear, that when we went through that fence, we grounded it out. I could hear the sparks on the ground. Now, the sparks might have been breaking wire. I have no idea. No, I can't tell you. But we went through that fence and made great, huge holes in that fence. And then when we get through the three layers, there was a little bank of slow stuff, and we went through. And then we all got in line like this, and we went up the hill toward the buildings that were up on top of the hill. And boy, we're ready. No, I'm a bazooka man. I got my bazooka right next to me. He's got his bazooka off his shoulders. He's putting the two pieces together and locking them up. And you know, and I've got my round out in my hand already. We don't know what's going to happen, but we're ready to bail off and go to work. You know, get out of that daggone tank destroyer. And we got up there, and then we stopped. And there was nothing there. Just all these buildings in front of us. And then slowly, from out behind the building, came all these people. And they were all dressed in funny, you know, blue and gray striped things, stripes about that wide, or 3/4 of an inch or so. And they came out, and we watched, and we couldn't see a soul with a weapon. And we didn't know. So our weapons are all going, you know, dropping down, pointing at the ground. And there's about 10 yards, maybe more, between us. And a voice out of that crowd over there said, "Are you American?" And we said, "Yes." And they just cheered and went nuts like mad. Then immediately our weapons pointed right at the ground. We knew there was nothing else to do. And our company commander and first sergeant were riding in a Jeep. The first sergeant then was Blowers, the picture you got of Blowers. And when we got there, the chimney thing at the crematorium was still belching black smoke, and it stunk. My God, it smelled. Now, what you must realize is that we never got a chance to bathe or shower or anything, and we were not the sweetest smelling group in the world at all. But this smell just made us smell like perfume, you know. And we got out there, and the Jeep and the guy who was in charge of the TDs and somebody else, and they went running off. And what they were doing, we didn't know, but what they were doing, going up and shutting off the crematorium, you know, because it was still running. There were still bodies on the trays. And they got it shut off, and it took a while for the smoke to start, but pretty soon you come in the Jeep all by himself is Blowers. He used to be our platoon sergeant. He's now the first sergeant. And he's telling his old platoon, us, to come with him. And we get on something, and he drives us around. And we go down the bottom at those holes in the fence. And he tells us, all right, he puts two of us at each hole in the fence all the way around. And he says, "Your job now, nobody goes through that hole. Nobody, either direction. You don't care which direction. You know, stop them." Well, he put Bill Justice and I off at this one hole, way, way down the corner, the furthest one down. And then he went down like this and then turned like this, and we were right there. And Bill and I were trying to figure out what the hell we'd run into. We thought of a prisoner of war camp. We didn't know. Didn't have the foggiest what we'd run into. And we were curious, and right across on the other side of that fence was a tower, a big old thing, 4 stories high, you know. And we're sitting there looking at the tower, and there isn't anybody. We didn't go through the fence. There's nobody near the fence. The only one near the fence are the two of us, you know. And so eventually, while we're talking and wondering and being curious, we go through the fence and we go over to this tower, and we're looking around the tower and trying to figure it out. And the tower is, the coating is stucco, gray stucco, and dirty. And the paint needs to be repainted, and it's around the door and all that. And it's a mess. But anyway, we're over there. And about that time, here comes Blowers back. You know? So we scramble back through the hole in the fence and get to where we're supposed to be. And he said, okay, we want you two guys up there in the top floor of the tower. And it's the same job. Nobody goes through that hole in the fence, either direction. You know? And he told us that the reason we were keeping the prisoners in is that Patton didn't want them out and crowding up the highway. He had to have the highways open so that he could get supplies and more troops and everything else. And Blowers also told us, he said, so don't worry about the prisoners. He said, there's a whole hospital unit on the way here. There's a kitchen unit on the way here. There are trucks full of food. We're going to take care of them. There's nothing we can do. You know, you can give them whatever food you got, but there's nothing we can do. But we don't want them crowding up the highway. We need the highways, you know. So we did. Bill and I went up there, and when we went in this tower, right there in the front of it was the door, and we went in, and on the bottom were all kinds of lockers around the edge. Now, you realize that the thing probably at the base, now they measured in meters, we didn't. My guess, the bottom was maybe 20 feet by 20 feet square. And the top one was 15 by 15, so it went up, you know, kind of slow. And we went in there, and the whole bottom is full of big lockers so that they can store things like mad down there. And on the wall opposite the door, there's a staircase going up. So we went over, and we went up the staircase. And on the next floor, there's a table in the middle, and some more smaller lockers, and this is where the German troops would have their meals. You know, they would eat there. And we looked at that, and then we went up the next flight. And up the next flight, there were around the edges, no lockers, but bunks, double-decker bunks all over, so that, you know, they'd work a shift upstairs and come down and they could sleep the shift. And then we went over, and now notice that all the steps are up the same side. You know, boom, boom, boom. And we went up the next one, and we had to push a door open. It was on hinges, and we pushed it open. And we went up there, and then we closed it, and it was a one solid floor once it was closed. And hanging from the middle of the ceiling was all of the hardware that made the searchlights work. Now, they weren't working now because the electricity is off. There they were. And then over in openings all the way around, in all directions, all the way around. And over on the front, looking over the camp, there was a big, heavy wooden table. Now, we'd have called it 2x, but in the metric system, I don't know what they called it. But they're heavy, heavy lumber. And you could tell it was rigged up to hold a machine gun. And Bill and I, we looked there, and we horsed around, and we got to talking, and from what Blowers had told us, we got the idea, okay, this is not a prisoner of war camp. There were no prisoners of war present. It was all German civilians, you know, and we had never, neither one of us, heard of a concentration camp. We didn't know what a concentration camp was. We were about to find out real close. So anyway, the two of us sat up there, and nobody came to our part of the fence. Nobody came down to the hole. We could just, so we stacked our rifles in the corner, and we sat on a machine gun table, and just went. And of course, we looked around, and we saw that area where we came up the valley and all that kind of crap. And we could look up on top, and there was another corner up there with another. And over here, going up, tower, 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 tower. And in the next one were Tim Daly and another guy. And anyway, we're there, and at about 4 o'clock that afternoon, this platoon sergeant from the 2nd platoon comes by, and he's got a bunch of guys with him, and they drop us off, not just one, you know, at my tower. And he comes up, and he takes over my tower, and then Bill and I get to go home. And we get on the truck, and we're going up the road. There's a road on the outside of the fence that goes all the way around. And we go up, and by the front gate, as you go, come down by the front gate, there's a road going like this, and we took the left turn, and then there's all kinds of real nice houses, which, you know, the officers of the staff worked in it, sort of way. And as you get to the first turn to the right, you go up, and there's a big barracks building sitting on the side. And that's where the truck took us, and they dropped us off, and Blower said, okay, get your bags. Now, all of our stuff was dumped right out in front. So we went out and found it. And he said, you guys are in this section over here. And we went in, and there were beds, mattresses, and there was showers, and we all took a shower. First one in months. We're kind of gaining. And we fed ourselves with the K rations we had. And then we went out, and there were a collection of guys sitting on the front steps and blowing stuff. He and the company commander and the other guy had traveled all over the place, and he'd gone through all the buildings and the houses, and he was telling us what they had run into. And he was explaining to us, and now we're starting to pick up what the hell a concentration camp is, and we're learning.
I'm going to stop you right there. I'm sorry. This is a good one. Okay.
Sergeant Blowers is telling us everything that they had found out about the place, and he's explaining to us about the crematorium. You know, we couldn't even dream of a crematorium. Okay, a crematorium. And he told us about the house that the camp commander had, and the camp commander's wife had taken Jewish prisoners out and lined them up naked and pointed at tattoos. And then the medical people would come by and they'd take the skin from that tattoo and they'd tan it and they'd make lampshades out of it, you know. And he said there were three of them. He saw three lampshades, you know. And he's telling us all this, and about that time, Bill and Tim and I decided, well, okay, we got to get out and walk around and see. We're going to look. So he said, well, all right, go down to the gate, go through the gate. You know, there's pictures of the gate in there. Go through the gate, and we went through the gate, and just inside of the gate there was bodies, naked, stacked about 6 feet high, you know, one layer like this, next layer like this, endless. And we're walking around in between them, and I remember, I'm still wearing my rifle. We didn't go anywhere without a rifle. You know, we went to lunch, we went to carry a rifle, you know. And I'm walking between those bodies, and I run into a guy from the company who's in there, and he says, boy, you want to see something, go over in there. And he points at this building, you know. So Tim and Bill and I looked at one another, and we went over there, and here was the crematorium. And you saw the picture of the different things. And they went on, and what they had done, Blowers and the company commander and the other, they had turned the crematorium off so that the bodies that were burning were part burned. You know, they didn't finish. But they went in and opened up and pulled the trays out, and all these partially burned bodies on the trays. And we're looking, and I remember I didn't look too long, I didn't look too hard, I'd had enough. And I turned around and got out of there, and Bill and Tim were right behind me. And that was enough. In fact, we left the whole place right there. That was enough. We didn't need any more. In fact, as we went out, we went by one of the barracks for these guys. And all the prisoners were hanging around there, you know. And boy, they were a sad-looking bunch of people. But we went out, and the three of us, just by ourselves, didn't go back to our barracks, didn't just went off into some woods and just walked around. That was enough. But we came back and we had been assigned some beds up there, and we had them, and we went in and went to sleep, and they woke us up at midnight, and we went on watch again, you know. And I remember on watch, I got down to my tower, and I was all alone. And I went up, the same one Bill and I were in earlier, the same one I went up there, and I stacked my rifle in the corner, and I crawled up on the table, and I'm sitting there on the table, and I'm smoking a cigar, and there's no lights, there's no electricity, nothing. And I'm smoking a cigar and wondering just what in the hell this is like. And then it comes to me, I'm a German. My mother is all German, 100% German. My father is half German, half Irish. What would it have been like if I had been born in Germany? You know, would I have been a part of that army? And I know for a fact I would have been a part of that army, but not that part of that army. You know, I'd have been off fighting someplace, doing something. But I would not have been at least not the way my mother raised me. I couldn't have stood it, that kind of crap that was going on. But that's sort of the way my mind was working. And I sat up there and I smoked my cigar, and then I had another cigar, I had two cigars. And not a soul bothered me. Nobody came down on my part of the fence. Until I was relieved. And then when I was relieved, I got in a truck and I went back up and I went to sleep again. Now, that's the way it went back and forth. There's a story about one of them. But it's interesting to note that when we finally packed up to go, we were all infested with bed bugs and fleas and all kind, and we had to be dusted for all of that. And that all came from the bed in the German barracks, you know. They were, oh. But anyway, one night, now, and when we went down, they come down this back corner, and I had that, and then there was an empty tower, and then Bill had one, and then there was an empty tower, and then Tim had one. So the three of us were, you know, close together. And the second night there, I was sitting there, and I had in field jacket pockets were stuffed with junk, but all these little packets of instant coffee, you know, little things, and sugar and all that. I had a pocket full of them. And what I did, I went through the tower, and all the chips of wood I could find, I grabbed them and brought them up, and then I lit a little fire on top of the machine gun table. And I heated up some water from my canteen in my canteen cup, and I made myself a cup of coffee, you know. So that from my tower, there you could see a fire. And I noticed about a half an hour later, there was one in Bill's tower, too. He must have gotten the idea. He must have gotten the idea. But anyway, that's the way it was. One afternoon when I was working, the first afternoon I was down there, a little guy, I was just sitting on that table, my rifle over against the corner, my helmet on the table beside me, and just sitting uncomfortable looking around, and you know, and this little voice is yelling at me, and I go and I look over the edge, and standing down in the hole in the fence is this tiny little kid that's, and he's wearing the uniform of a prisoner, you know, he is a prisoner, and I found out later he was probably born in the place, but he's yelling up at me, and I think, come on up to the way he's in there, he's up the steps and he's in there. And we have a problem. I can't speak his language and he can't speak mine, you know. So we're trying to communicate with one another. We start with nouns, names, I am, you know. And then we then get around to a few verbs. And anyway, it struck me, okay, I got in my pocket, in my jacket pocket, I got a Hershey bar. So I reach into my jacket pocket and I pull out the Hershey bar and I give it to him, you know. And he looks at it and he, oh, that's nice, and gives it back, you know. And I thought, uh-oh. So I tear it and I tear open a corner and I break off a little piece of chocolate on it and I put it in my mouth and I eat it, you know, and I hand it back to him. And he's watching me and he tears off a little bit when I had it. And he his eyes just light up, just, oh. And I take the Hershey wrapper and I'm, ooh, gooses. Canadian gooses. I tucked the word chocolate across the bottom of the bar, and I said, chocolate, and I pointed this, chocolate. We learned another word for the two of us. And then he tried to give me the candy bar back, and I said, no, that's yours, you keep it, you know. So he does. And then later on, in my pocket, I've got one of these discs that came in K rations or C rations, they all over the place. Cocoa, you could break it open and put it in your can, heat up the water and make yourself a cup of cocoa. So we did the same thing again. We lit the fire and we made a hot cup of cocoa and I gave it to him to drink and he said, chocolate, put it all together, you know. So, all right, so came time to get relief. I'm going, and I like cigarettes. I just reach in and grab a cigarette and put the pack back in it. He asked me for a cigarette, and my first thought is, I don't want this young kid smoking. Heck with it, you know.
How old did he look?
He looked to be somewhere between 7 and 9, 7 and 10, somewhere in that area, very young. I don't want this kid smoking. And then it struck me, that's money. If I give him those cigarettes, he can take them up and he can trade around. So I reach in, I've got cigarettes in all my pockets. And I gave him two packs of cigarettes. And his eyes said, oh, and then he goes back up to the camp. Well, he came back the next day, too. And I called him up right away. Good, his story. We're up there. And what I have done, I have taken several clips of my M1 ammunition and I have pried open and pulled out the slug and put the slug over here and then poured all the powder in the middle of the machine gun table. And then all that's left is the firing cap. And I put it in the rifle and I pull the trigger and it goes bang, you know, not much of a bang, just a little bit of a bang. And then the second one I let him do. So he can barely hold up the damn rifle. Almost standing taller than he is. And he's sitting there and he's shooting these caps, you know. And we're building up a good pile of powder out here at the table, you know. And eventually I get out a match and I light the whole thing. It goes, oh, you know. But about that time, a bunch of the prisoners come up the valley. And my first thought is, how in the hell did he get out there? I'm not supposed to let them out there. Well, it turned out I didn't let them out. The guy who had the morning shift let them out. And they promised him that they would not go on roads. Okay, go ahead. They went down to the nearest village all across country. And here they were coming back, and right in the middle of them, they had this one person, and they had a rope around this person, and they were leading him. And they were bringing him back, and they were going to go back in the camp. And I thought, well, what the hell? Why not? I'm not going to stop from going in, you know. And they did, but they are talking to me in this language. I don't know any of. But the little guy, my little guy, he knows the language. And he's telling me he's got to go with him. The guy in the middle, it used to be a German guard at the prison, you know. And they have caught him. And they're bringing him back to the prison. And the little guy wants to join him. But he asked me, could you have some more cigarettes? So I said, okay, I got another pack of cigarettes. And I give him to him. And he goes, and Bill, up there in the tower over there, saw it all, and Tim saw it all. And when we're relieved and walking back, they asked me, what's going on? So I tell them. They said, well, I think they got one of the guards. So we got up, and we looked. And it turns out that they went in. If we had those pictures of Buchenwald, I could show you where they were. They were in a row of buildings that on either side of the gate. They were the one way down at the far left. And Bill and Tim and I went in there. Now, we are American soldiers. We're carrying our rifles. We do everywhere. We don't go without them, you know. And we walk in the room, and the room is full of Buchenwald prisoners, and standing in the middle is this one German guard. No ropes, no nothing, just standing there. And sitting in a chair in front of him is one of the older prisoners, and he's asking him questions and getting answers and back and forth and back and forth. And then after a while, he just looks up and shakes his head yes, and some of the prisoners bring over a table, and he gets put the prisoner up on the table, and then they give him a rope, and he ties his own noose, and he doesn't tie it right. They make him take it apart and make him tie it right with 13 rings going up, just make sure it's just exactly right. And then they put him on the table, and he fashions that noose to an electrical fixture up in the ceiling, or to a hook in the ceiling, or something the Germans had built into the ceiling. And then they make him put it around his neck, And then he pulls it up so it's a little bit snug, and ties the rope to itself. And then he jumps, and then they caught him. They put him back on the table, and they made him walk off the table slowly. And then they pull the table away from him, and he just dangled there. His hands are free. He can do anything he wants. But slowly he just choked to death. And his face turned every color you could imagine. And I remember I'm sitting there, and Tim and Bill and I, all three of us, all we had to do was take the rifles off our shoulder, and we could have stopped the whole thing. And we didn't. I looked at them, and they looked at me, and we just turned around and walked out and went somewhere, just got out of there. Bill said he went back later that night, and the room was empty, except for the body hanging in the middle. But they got that prisoner. They got that guard. I don't know what the guy did to them, but he's not going to do it anymore.
How long were you at Buchenwald? How long were you there?
Whether it's 3 or 4 days, I couldn't tell you exactly, but it was not more than 4, if not less than 3. The second day we were there, an outfit that was in Weimar, Germany, took the people that were in Weimar, Germany, and lined them up, all of them, the whole civilian population, and marched them down the road. It was about a 7-mile march. Marched them down the road and marched them through Buchenwald so that they could see Buchenwald, so that they would know what they were responsible for. And on the way back, some of them were laughing and making jokes, and they just turned the whole gang around and made them come through again. Now, I was on watch down in my tower, so I had to get the story later, but anyway, they got home, and the mayor of Weimar and his wife both committed suicide. Now, and that was the end of that nonsense. And then later on, when we loaded up to go off and go back to work again, we were on trucks and we were going through Weimar. And I remember going right through downtown, and I remember the big church downtown. And that big church in Weimar is Herderkirche. I don't know. Johann Gottfried Herder was the pastor that built that church. He'd been a teacher of Goethe. He was a leader of the Sturm und Drang School of Poetry. And I have no idea whether or not he's in my string or not. I do know if you go back from me to Dad, it's Harry to Harry, and then to his father, Hugo, and then to his father, Frederick. And Frederick must have been born. I've got the date someplace. My brother Jim looked at it for me. Right at the beginning of 1800 and something, like 1810 or something like that. And Johann Gottfried died at about the same time. So Frederick, my great-great-grandfather, could have been a grandson of Johann Gottfried. He might not have been.
Do you know where in Germany your family came from?
Where what?
where in Germany your family came from?
Yeah, it's on that picture.
Is it near this town, Weimar?
Pardon?
Is it near Weimar?
No.
How do you spell Weimar? How do you spell Weimar? V-I-M-E-R?
W-E-I. Somewhere, that picture of the Herder family.
Yeah, I think it's maybe in that other pile.
Oh, yeah.
It's on stiff board.
Yeah. Here it is.
Yeah, and the name of the town is Berlin N.O. Große Frankfurter Straße. And the name of the photographer is over there on the bottom, too. And that's Frederick, the father. The mother, I think, is Marie. And Anna, Hugo's sister, Anna, married an Otto in Red Wing. And there's a whole gang of Ottos in Red Wing now that are... She had a big family.
Do you know if you still have family in Germany?
I have no idea. I'm awfully curious, but I have no idea. I couldn't answer it.
And what happened after Buchenwald then? Where did you go after that?
Okay, we got on trucks and we rode. And we rode on these autobahns. So we weren't always around. Now, the big trucks can't go that fast. You know, they're limited in how fast they can go. But we were at that limit, and we were rolling down there, and we came to some smaller town, not a village, but a smaller town, and the whole rest of our battalion was there. And we pulled in, and they had some houses set aside for us, you know. And we pulled in, and I remember the guys from B Company and some of the other ones came over. Where you guys been? What have you been doing? And we were trading stories. And we get the word that, okay, you're sleeping here tonight, but boy, we're gone in the morning, you know. They had been there 2 or 3 days already. In fact, the whole group, we were the last ones from the battalion to get there. But the word was that we were all going to go, and they were going to make 3 salients out of us. And C Company and D Company were to be on the east edge, the left edge, and A and B were way over on the right edge, and we were going to make 3 finger points and go right straight for Regensburg and the Danube River, Regensburg being on the other side of the Danube River. And we shoved off that day, and we take mostly cross country, and by then we're on TVs again. The trucks are gone. We're on TVs again, and we're running. And I remember that we were going up one hill, and there was still snow on the hills, you know, and the Jeep turned over and rolled down to the bottom, and some tank went down and rolled it up and got it on its feet again, and up it came again, away we went. And we got up to the top of the hill, and there was a forest, and we were going through a forest, and here were all these guys in German uniforms, and they didn't have a weapon anywhere. They had shovels and axes and all kinds of funny things working for them. And we just blew right on by them. They just all got off on the side of the trees. And we just blew right on by them, no horsing around. And we came to quite a big town. And there was a river right on the top of it. And we crossed. And I don't know the name of the town. I never did. We went through Germany, and I don't think I ever had a map. I know the names of very few places that we were. But as I look back on it now, I think it was Bamberg, but I'm not sure. I could be dead wrong. And we got through to the far edge of town, so that we had gone through town, and we were the first American troops there. And we just blew on through, and all the people are just looking like mad, you know. And we get down the far edge, and there's an area where there's farmers. And we walked into this one farmhouse and just took it over. And our company commander was in the same building we were in, which threw we were back with Sergeant Blowers again. And Sergeant Blowers took our new platoon sergeant and said, okay, get a patrol out there, get out on the road in front of us. We don't want anybody sneaking up on us. So they get a half a dozen of us, and I was one of them. And we went on down the road into the farm and to the crossroad, and we're in the ditch. And we're just kind of leaning back and resting. Now, we hadn't done a lot of work. All we'd done all day long is ride. You know, we weren't pooped or tired or anything like that. And we're sitting there, and all of a sudden we can hear this noise down the road, and it's clanking metals and one thing another, and we all get up and we get alert, and coming up the road, and we can't see it, it's dark, but coming up the road is a German patrol, German soldiers, the Wehrmacht. You know, and about the time they get even us, we can tell, okay, that's who they are. So we just get up and shot them all and dragged them off the road. And when we opened up, why, the rest of the people in the house back there came out, and Blowers took over and took charge. He said, okay, get down the road further. They'll be coming after you now. You know, so we went down there. But anyway, we took off in the morning. And as we're going down this, now we're back in the back country. We're going down a road, but we're on TDs. We got trucks behind us, our trucks empty. And we go by this village, and as we go by the village, we slow down a little bit. It's off maybe a quarter of a mile up the road over here. And a couple of three shots came out of that village, and one of them, well, no, wasn't Blowers, wasn't the first sergeant yet. One of them got the guy that was Sloboka, was our first sergeant. That's when Blowers took over as being first sergeant. And another one just missed our company commander and went into the Jeep. And boy, we piled off our TDs and we went run up to that village. We had to clean it up, you know. And in those German houses, the halls are about this wide, and the doors are about this wide, and the M1 is this long. we're trying to get that damn big M1 through all those spaces, you know, or kind of thing. You can't use it when it's like this. But anyway, we found half a dozen German soldiers. They were hiding in the basement, and we just piled them out and marched them down the road and set them there. The 71st Division was coming behind us, and we just set them there with a guard. And the 71st Division picked them up as prisoners.
Were they armed?
Oh, yeah.
So no shots were fired?
No. They surrendered. We came down that basement steps and they were surrendering. On the whole. Anyway, we got back up and we're going back to the road. And we're switching now from the TDs to the trucks because we had no idea. We were then less than a mile from the river. We had no idea. We didn't know where Regensburg was. We didn't know anything. But the way the land is built there, we were up on a high plateau. And then there's all kinds of trees, and then the river, and then flat plains all over the place. And we're up here playing around. And we get back in our trucks, and we could hear it, a pop. And it's a mortar round, and we know what mortar rounds, you know, sound like when they're starting off. And the first thing we thought, the damn thing's up there somewhere. And pretty soon there was another one. Another one. And Blowers got one squad of us. He said, come on, we gotta go get them. And we took off up the hill. Now, where the trucks were, there was an orchard, an apple orchard. And everybody else in the company is scattering around that orchard and hiding. And Blowers takes us, and we go up a hill, and then down, and then go up another hill, and there they are in front of us on a hill up here. A hole in the ground with a mortar in it, and four German soldiers operating the mortar. And my first thought, okay, I've got to get with Smokey. Wherever Smokey is, I got it, because he might want to download that bazooka on
him. And this is Stover you're talking about?
Yeah. Did you realize that there was a comic strip in the paper on Smokey Stover?
No.
Yeah, back in those days, there was and Smokey Stover had a helper called Big Stoop, and I became Big Stoop. With Smoke, and I found Smokey, and I'm running over to where Smokey was, and we're just getting all loaded up and set to go, And it turns out that Lenny Ahurst is down here on the hill with his BAR. And by the time we get ready to go, Lenny's taking all four of them out.
So for the record, what a BAR? The acronym BAR.
Browning Automatic Rifle.
Browning Automatic Rifle.
Yeah. A barman. Oh, and Lenny was good. God, he was good. But anyway, we laid those four out, and we all went over there. And the thing we did was to take, we left the bodies there. We didn't, you know, didn't play with them. But we took the mortar apart in its pieces and scattered them all over the hill. You know, nobody's going to put that one together again for a while. You know. So we went back and got in our truck, and we're going up, and as we go over the top of a hill, the road dead ends right here, and there's one coming down like this. And on the one coming down, there's two Germans on motorcycle, one in a little carrier on the side, and Lenny stands up in the truck over the cab with his BAR here, and three bursts, got both of them. Moving target. Lenny was good. He didn't know what's wrong with Lenny. And of course, the motorcycle went spilling all over the place. And we just rolled by it. We didn't even stop to look. And we didn't even go a quarter of a mile. We went up to the T, and then a quarter of a mile, and then there was another road that went straight down the hill. Two trees, thick, couldn't see anything. And boy, we took off down that hill, and right at the bottom of the hill, there was another parallel road like this, and the bridge, and the Danube, you know. And boy, we went across that bridge in a hurry and nailed it down. And got it over there, so if the Germans tried to come back and take that bridge and close us down while we had it, and they weren't going to get it. And that night, nobody came. They left it alone. They took, we had 30 caliber machine guns in the company. And just down, oh, part of this area was a very small village with a hotel. And we went in that hotel, and of course what we did is stole food out of the kitchen, but went in that hotel, and the machine gun had a window at the third story. It was looking right out. If the Germans were going to attack that bridge, they had to come down that floodplain. And Smokey and I went in the next room with the bazooka. And that morning when we woke up, the fog was so thick that we couldn't even see the ground under us. You know, we were worthless. So they came and got us. And we went down there, and this time there were trucks waiting for us, and they put us all on trucks, and we went back up the hill. And as we got back up the hill, there was the 71st Division, all set to just coming down the hill. And they looked at, who are you guys? Where have you been? They didn't know there was anybody in front of them. But we took off down that road. We stayed on the north edge of the Danube. And we were working our way, and I had no idea. We were very close to Austria. But I didn't know that. We went by a town of Straubing, which was on the other side of the river, too. But we went by, and pretty soon we just decided we got hungry. And then now, by now we're switched over and we're on TDs again and rolling like mad. And the TD commanding officer and the first lieutenant and our commanding officer, first lieutenant, just our platoon is all it was, decided, okay, let's stop and get some food. And we went into the nearest farm we could get and walked in, and the poor farmer and his wife, and here we are all, and we're crummy looking. You know, we're dirty and unshaven and carrying weapons. So somebody who did barely speak a little bit of German explained what we wanted. We were hungry. We wanted food. So the farmer points at the hen house. So I'm assigned as one of the original ones to go in and get us a bunch of chickens, clean them up, prepare them so that they can be used in the kitchen. And so we do. We get maybe a half a dozen, eight chickens. We got them all cleaned up and everything. And then they brought them to the lady, and she made chicken and dumplings. And we all sat in the kitchen. And did the guys from the TDs and our platoon, and you know, and it, they were sitting there and they were watching us eat. And I said, "Come on over and join us, you know, and sit down and eat." And they couldn't understand it. But they did. They sat down. We all sat there. And because I had been on the crew that cleaned up the chickens, I didn't have to be on the crew that cleaned up the kitchen afterwards. And they, you know, picked out a whole bunch of other guys to do the kitchen. And I just went outside and crawled up on the TD, and I sat there under the, right next to the cannon. I'm sitting there looking across, and I can see the whole floodplain. And up there, there's Straubing, and there's Regensburg up there. And the floodplain is full of canals, you know. And some of the canals have got barges in them all tied up, and none of them moving around, you know. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm enjoying the view of Germany. And our lieutenant and the tank destroyer lieutenant come out of the house. And they're standing there on the top of the hill looking, and they look at one of the barges, and it's got a covered roof on it, the whole thing. And the tank destroyer guy brags to our lieutenant, "You know, I can knock that thing out of here." And our guy said, "Nah, it's too far away, you'll never get it." He has his watch, and he got up, and he got inside the TD I was on, and I got off of it. And he cranked it up, and he brought the gun around, and he got the gun, and he loaded it up, and he fired, and he, sure enough, he hit it. Boy, and it was full of chlorine gas. What they did down in Regensburg and Straubing were making, you know, treating iron and stuff, and they used chlorine as part of the processes. You know, it wasn't there to be a poison gas. It was there for an industrial use. But when he put the hole in the thing, all that poison gas was getting out. And here comes the 71st Division down the road, and all this chlorine gas, and over the radio on the tank, the word. Boy, you should have seen us get out of there. We didn't know what's around. We got the hell out. And then we got down into Austria ways. And by the way, that's the end of the war for us. It wasn't over, but there's no more shooting.
And you basically went through the towns and had them pull out their weapons so that you could burn them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, in one of those two books, it's the story of that is a little bit.
Okay. Maybe we should take a short break.
Do what?
We'll take a short break.
Okay. I'll buy that.
You have the most amazing stories.
Anyway. You're going to ask Linda.
Okay.
I got on a train down at Fort Camp McCoy, Wisconsin. Are you getting it?
Wait, let me ask you the question. Oh, yeah, we should put your mic back on.
Oh, hang on a sec.
We're professionals.
How do I get that up? Or doesn't it matter?
Oh, Harry, we're so hard on you.
There it is.
There.
There you go.
Perfect. Hold on. Wait. Oh, it's still going. Now, let me ask you the question. What was your homecoming like when you got out of the Army in World War II?
I got on a train down at Camp McCoy. I got to Camp McCoy with hardly a day's, what you call it, from Massachusetts. The boat landed in Boston. And I got on the train at Camp McCoy, and I was riding the train, and the company commander from B Company of the 5th Rangers was beside me, and we were talking. And he said, "What are you going to do?" You know. His name is Pepper, by the way. He's buried in up at Fort Snelling. But we're talking, and we're just talking about he's from St. Paul. He's it's interesting. A guy from Anoka in A Company, a guy from St. Paul in B Company, company commanders. But anyway, we're talking, and the train gets to Red Wing, and I get up, and I grab my big old barracks bag and all that stuff, and I get off. And right at the bottom of the steps is my mother and my father and three of my brothers, but one of them is still in mother's arms like this. And I get down and all the hollows and everything, and then mother says, here, take your baby brother, meet your baby brother. And she puts Bob in my arms, you know. So we go off and we go home, and mother has baked, and I told them by mail, I wrote a letter. I said, boy, I haven't had any mince pie in a long time. And mother baked a whole mince pie. And I got home that night and I ate the whole damn thing. And none for the family. I got it, boy, it's gone. And mother gets a big kick out of it. But anyway, so we had a long time just sitting in the dining room. And Dick asked a question or two. Jim didn't, he's too small. But Dad asked questions like, man, and mother asked a few. But that's what it was like to come home.
And what was how were you feeling?
Oh.
How were you feeling when you got home?
I'm not just glad. We weren't in Germany anymore, so that part of it was over. I didn't have to carry an M1 rifle around anymore. My steel helmet was off someplace else. I have no idea where that went. I was just in uniform and at home. And better than that, the next morning I woke up, and I didn't put my uniform back on. I put on my old civilian clothes from years ago.
Was the adjustment back to civilian life hard for you?
No. It wasn't hard for me because all of my classmates, everybody, had been in the service. And we were all out. We were all together. And I got 60-day leave on that one, and it would have ended before Christmas, and I would send a wire back, could I get one that lasts through Christmas, and they sent me an extension that went through Christmas and New Year's. So I had, almost 70 days at home. You know? And I spent all my money. I didn't have any money left. So while I was home, I got a job at the post office delivering Christmas mail. You know? And then I had to sell my Model A to get back to camp. But anyway, it wasn't bad. We, for the most part, we wore our uniforms on again, but, you know, our street clothes.
And then after the leave, you went back to camp?
Then we went, my orders were to report back to Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri, and I got there, and I didn't last long there. They sent me over to Camp Atterbury in Indiana. And I was there about a week, and then they gave me my discharge, and then I went home. And I no sooner got home than I had to report up to St. Thomas because the spring semester was starting. You know, and so I got home, and I wasn't home 2 days. I was on my way up to St. Thomas.
So were you on the GI Bill?
Oh, yeah. And that's part of my problem. I got up there, and I'm sitting there. At that time, January, February area of 1946, there's nothing but guys coming home from the service. They're all veterans of one kind or another. And St. Thomas is loading up, boys, and getting a whole bunch of guys that had been in St. Thomas before the war, who went in during the war, were now coming back. And there were a whole, 4 years of guys that graduated from high school all coming out and getting out. So we were there, and there were lines and lines and lines of friends. We had to get a line to get to sign this guy. And I remember I was in the bookstore line to get some books. They already knew what classes I was going to take to get some books. And standing right behind me was a guy. Boy, that guy I showed you was Mr. Tommy,
mm-hmm.
Davy Bro. And he just, I'm just standing there trying to mind my own, and this guy taps me on the shoulder. He says, "Aren't you Pudge Herder?" And I said, "Yeah." And I looked, and it was Davy Bro. Mm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was Davy. And we're not going far into someplace else. And there's here's another one for you, too. Another guy. A guy I'd gone through the first 8 grades with. Eddie Hagerty. Eddie came up. And I recognized him as he walked up to me. He recognized me from over there. But, Eddie and I grew up for the first 8 grades at St. Joseph's School. In fact, he's in Let's see if I can find a picture of Eddie. He's in there someplace hiding. Down when Rip Lambert got killed nowhere. Jack Haven. Oh, Eddie, where'd you go? This guy flew airplanes and jumpers in D-Day, Alan Hughes. This guy, Archie Stark, is the one that joined us later. He's a Marine, went through several islands in the Pacific. Here's Eddie right there. There's Eddie Haggerty. But Eddie was on a boat called the Gambier Bay and was in the Battle of Lady Gulf, and they sank it. And he was floating around in the Lady Gulf for well over a day, surrounded by sharks and everything, before they pulled him out and saved him. But there's a whole book on that. And Eddie right now is a lawyer. He's up in Minneapolis. Would you like to see that book?
Sure.
Sure.
Hang on a sec.
Put this back in the book. Okay. Eddie is a lawyer in Minneapolis. He's now retired. His son has got the firm.
Mm-hmm.
But lives over in Normandy, something or other, south of 494.
So he's quoted in this book.
But anyway, this is a more recent book. And I got a hold of one. Brother Dick gave it to me. But it's about the Battle of Lady Gulf. And they mention the Gambier Bay. So I quick got on the email to Eddie and told him about this. Yeah, he said, I've read it. He said they had a couple of things wrong.
Now, you said you had a problem with the GI Bill when you you alluded.
The second semester I came back up, or the first semester we had spring football, and my line coach at the time was Ed Widseth. That won't mean a thing to you, but he made All-American twice. Mm-hmm. You know, he played for Bernie Behrman, hell of a football player, played for the Giants for a long time. But anyway, there were seven or eight of us. There were seven or eight of us all trying out for the position of tackle on the St. Thomas football team. And that spring, we had some good wars, just, you know, off in a corner, just the linemen. And at the end of the spring, it got down, there were two of us that were going to be the ones. And so when we came in fall, I was expecting, okay, I'm going to be there. And we went up in the fall early, and the first 5 days we didn't put pads on, and then the sixth day we put pads on. And Digger Dyke, the coach, decided he'd like to have a scrimmage, so he named a team, and he named a tackle Herder, and I started to move, and he said, no, not that Herder, the other one. And my brother had gotten out of the Coast Guard and had come up. And he went over there. And I just looked around and I looked at Mr. Whitseth. He just shrugged his shoulders and didn't do anything else. So I got back up and they got the team they wanted in the huddle over there. And he said, okay, now we need a defense. So, man, I put myself right in front of where my brother was going to be. You know, I know horsing around. And Ed Woodson just shook his head. Yeah. The very first play they ran, I hit him right in the nose. There weren't any face masks, you know. We didn't have them. And I didn't horse around. I pounded him, you know. And then I got by him, and I got into the backfield, and I made a tackle. And the next time he comes out of the huddle, he's ready. You know, I'm not going to do that again. So I made like I was going to, got in my stance, and I had my hand down here ready to go, you know. And they snapped the ball, and I went under him, you know. And he went over the top of me, going to punch me, you know. And I went under him like mad, and I'm up in the back of it, and I made a tackle, you know. And the third time he comes out, I'm not going to do that either. So he's all set to take a punch, but he's all set not no more diving under. This time I leapfrogged him in the back of it. And Digger the Dyke says, okay, get the other herder in there. That was and my brother was cut from the team about 2 weeks later. But anyway, we went, and I was named the starting tackle.
We'll pause here again. You're going to change something?
Let me see if I can find another one here.
12 in total.
Oh, 12 tracks in total.
Well, we're done.
We're on the 13th track.
Right. So how many?
I don't know. We're paging through the 1947 edition of the Aquinas Yearbook from St. Thomas.
Yes.
And we just looked at one of your football
classes. Look at all the good. Good. This is the senior class of 47. John Carpenter, I remember him well. I didn't know many of these guys. Most of us.
How many guys? Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
How many guys, the percentage that were on the GI Bill, would you guess?
Oh, most of them were now. Like, Fredo was the linebacker behind me. And he had been at St. Thomas before the war and then gone into war and then came back. And the same thing with Bill Funk. He was our quarterback. Yeah, but most of us were young. Most of us were a long way to go.
How much did it help you, the GI Bill? What were you getting?
Okay, let me do that later.
Oh, okay.
Save that. That's the reason I didn't finish at St. Thomas.
Oh, okay.
My freshman year there, I was living in the dormitory. Maybe I can find that in here, too. I don't know where the... Here's the homecoming queen. Who cares? Oh, and these guys. Yeah, I remember them, so many of them. Where in the hell do you have flags go? Here it comes. So many of these guys. Now, this guy, Jocko McKenzie, had been a captain in the 82nd Airborne. And the next year, he was gone, too. He was off the University of Nevada in Reno. This is the Ed Widsith I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And there's Digger the Dyke.
We're looking at football photographs for the tape.
Yeah.
On pages, what are the page numbers, Harry?
The page number here is 109.
Okay. 109. There's a photograph of Harry with other members of the team.
Yeah, that's the starting lineup. Yeah, in those days, there was no offense and defense. If you were in, you were in, period, for the whole game. If you came out as a substituted for, and say, in the first period, you couldn't get back in the game until the second period. Yeah. And no helmets, of course. No, face mask. And Frank Naaman was pretty good. Oh, here's our star ball player, Jack Solcheter. He ended up with the Giants, too. For years, he had the record with the Giants for the longest intercepted pass run back, 99 yards. You know. He had some foot speed, a lot of it. We weren't bad. We were pretty good. We lost the first two games. Every game we played that year, every game, was rain. It rained and rained. It was across the river. Strangers. They're going in. Here's Davy Brill again. He's in that picture over there someplace. It's Davy Brill again. Tame the Redmen, 14-6. Trample St. John's, 18-0. Oh, I thought they scored a touchdown. I guess they didn't. St. John's story. In the rain, playing at St. Paul Central. The grass is big. We're slow. Everybody's slow. Nobody's running fast in the grass. And we're having trouble. And we punted the ball this one time. And it was a short punt. It wasn't a good punt. And their front guy caught it rather than the catcher back there. And I was downfield, and I hit him. And we hit head-to-head like this and bounced apart. And he fumbled. And then we recovered. I didn't. But somebody on our team did. And then we were running the ball. And I woke up, and I was in the huddle, and it was third down. And I looked at Davey Brum. I said, what the hell happened? He's there. He said, our ball, we're going. And I said, well, how am I doing? He said, you're doing all right. You're doing all right. Back in the huddle. And here we beat. Oh, yeah. We played McAllister and beat the crap out of McAllister. I remember McAllister had a guy who played in the 45, had not been in the service, and had made all-conference, and was supposed to be a very, very good tackle. And all week long, Woodseth is on my case. Oh, you're going to have trouble. You're going to... I pointed him in the nose the first play of the game. He was my, I had him for the rest of the game. I told him, okay, now I'm going here. Now, leave it alone.
Now, when you say punched in the nose, do you mean with an elbow... You shielded the punch? Are you illegal?
when you're in lineman, you're working in close. You don't care. You get them. I didn't use my elbows much, but I used my forearms a whole lot.
And he was out?
Well, not quite, but he was tamed. I had no more problems with him. McAllister ran a single wing. And they had a black guy over at the wing back over here. And I was a tackle on their left side, our right side. And every time they ran a reverse, he would have to come over to me. And, of course, my guy wasn't blocking me anymore. So I had a shot at him every time. And we beat McAllister pretty good. They had a nice team, no problem. And after I lost my leg and I got assigned to University of Illinois, I was playing goalie. Oh, they're moving somebody. They were playing goalie for the hockey team with a wooden leg. And there was this guy in the athletic department at the university who was trying to start wheelchair athletics. And he came over to get me. He said, do you want to try wheelchair basketball? And I said, well, all right, but as long as it doesn't interfere with the hockey. He said, we'll work it. And he said, do you want to play wheelchair football? Yeah, so we're playing wheelchair football. And we're playing indoors in the armory on dirt. No grass, on dirt. And I'm going down for a pass this one time, and I'm going like this. And this guy who's defending me back grabs both handles of the river, boom, pulls me, and he puts me on the deck, and I'm looking up, and I see who it is. And the next time I go down there, he's about to do the same thing, and I reach with my elbow, and I come backwards, like, and I hit him right in the head. Oh, I didn't horse around. I laid it on him. And the referee, a black referee, came over, and he threw a flag on me at 15 yards. And said, for you. So after the game, I said, well, what are you doing that to me for? He said, come on, Herder, I know you. And I said, what are you talking about? And it was the guy who was the wingback from McAllister. And he remembered me. And I thought,
oh. Oh, yeah. What year was this again?
46. No, in Illinois, it was... I got to think. And... What year were we at Illinois?
63 to 6.
Here's a name you're very, very likely to remember. Right there.
Johnny Kunla?
Yeah.
K-U-N-D-L-A.
You don't remember that? The Minneapolis Lakers?
He coached him in the upper league.
Oh, okay.
He went from St. Thomas to the University of Minnesota to the Minneapolis Lakers.
He coached Mikan.
What?
He coached Mikan.
Yeah. And Mickelson and all those guys. Pollard. Yeah. He's one of that gang. And he was the backfield coach for our football team.
Oh, okay.
And he wanted me to play basketball. He tried to get me to come up for St. Thomas basketball. And I went out. He didn't have any draw. No problem. But I wasn't very good. I played football much the same way. Oh, Sheldon Bisey. Yeah, his Kundla in the back. But I played basketball the same way I played football. If you drive the lane, man, I got you.
Contact sport.
Stay out of my lane. So he gave up on me in basketball. What he did, he lined up a schedule. The season was over, and he was playing around with all the possibilities. And he worked out a scrimmage against the University of Minnesota. And the University of Minnesota had a big old guy, 6'10", 6'11", named McIntyre. And he was strong. He eventually became a minister someplace. But I couldn't move him around. He was just, because when I'm in the hole, I'm in charge of it, But not with him. He was in charge of that daggone thing. And I remember one time I went up and I was going for a rebound, and there he was way over the top of me, and I made a fist, and I hit him right in the eye. I gave him a black eye. And And anyway, that was just before the state tournament, and Red Wing was in the state tournament that year. And I was over there just trying to find a way to sneak in to watch, around big gymnasium. And we came by, and there's McIntyre working a gate. And he recognized me. You want to get in? He snuck me in. The two of us, he snuck us both in. I played basketball in the Army, and I did not play on the base team. I played on the regimental team. I was not good enough to make the base team. But I played on the regimental team. And the guy who played tackle on the other end of the Fort Bragg football team was from the 505. And we got to be great friends. We're good. But he also played basketball for his 505. I was 504. And I remember this one time, he was going down court, and they got him the ball. And he was right on the edge of the court, just barely inbounds. And I wouldn't let him turn in. I ran him four or five levels up on the stands.
Referees loved you.
Yeah. he looked at me and said, "I'll get you."
So, getting back to St. Thomas, when did you graduate?
This story. That was my second semester. Mm-hmm. And that whole semester, the GI Bill goofed up, and I never got a penny. And I worked that summer. I was going to have a summer job all summer at the Red Wing swimming pool. But that summer, they had the polio scare. And they closed up everything. So I ended up picking celery down on the celery farm. But I didn't have any money. So I went up to school. And I had fixed it up that spring so they wouldn't let me back in the dormitory anymore. Because the night of the second Lewis Kahn fight, I got all full of beer. I was crawling around the edge of the building trying to get to my window so I could get in. And I went by the priest's window, and there he was staring at me. So the next fall, they wouldn't let me in that dormitory anymore, so I couldn't eat downstairs in there. But anyway, I didn't have any money at all. And I got a room, I can't remember the name of the street, but down the street. And I went all the way through September, October, November, and then late in December, I finally got a check for all my money. In the meantime, I didn't have anything to eat. My weight went from 235 down to 180. I was hungry. Dad had come up to a football game and give me $5 and say, okay.
Sorry to interrupt, would you?
Wouldn't even think of it.
He always says, I'm good for something around here. You didn't say it this bad.
But I didn't have any money. But I was just broke all the time. So I didn't even go back. I didn't even finish the semester. I just did the hell with it and went back in the Army.
How much money did you get at the end of the semester?
Oh, I got it. We were entitled to $60 a month. And then they paid our tuition and books. But that's what I would have gotten. So when they finally caught me up, it was September, October, November, December, $200 and some.
So you went back into the Army when? What year?
When did these? Yeah, it was January of 47.
And where were you stationed?
I went to jump school, first of all, at Fort Benning, and then after that I went up to Fort Bragg.
And you were at Fort Bragg until Korea? You were at Fort Bragg then until Korea, or?
No, I put the whole 3-year hitch in at Fort Bragg. And again, I jockstrapped that one. Good Lord. I was on the Fort Bragg football team. I was on the 504 basketball team. I was on the 504 baseball team. I swam in the Third Army swim meet down in, and I did a lot of Wednesday night fighting. So I didn't pull much duty. You know, when you saw me with that agate going with the 57, once in a while I'd get out and play soldier. But that's the way I put my whole second hitch in.
Why did you decide to go back in?
I was hungry. I was hitchhiking south. I was trying to. I got dropped out of St. Thomas, and I was hitchhiking south, and I was aiming at Florida. And I got very close. I got down to a town in the Brewton, Alabama, which is 10 miles from Florida. And I was selling Olin Mills portraits. And I'd go up and knock on a door and then make an appointment, and they'd pay me 50 cents for the appointment, and that 50 cents was mine. And I wasn't a very good salesman either, but I put my southern accent back together again. And, you know, but I remember that going. It started one morning, and I was. There were four of us, and they gave us a section of town we were supposed to work, you know. And I get going in and going through the what's it called in the front yard right there by the front gate. They had roses, oh, just beautiful little white roses going like mad. And I picked one off and put it in my jacket. And I got up to the door, and the lady said, "You stole the flower." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I did." And it's right here. She said, "Well, you leave my flowers alone." I said, "Okay." And I picked it out, and I gave it to her. And I turned around, walked out, went down, and left in the Army. That was enough of that nonsense. So I did. I went back in the Army, and I got in, and they sent me up to, I think it was Camp McClellan, from the recruiting station, and I took the test and everything, and they tried to talk me into going to OCS, you know, and I thought, no, I got jump school, I'm going to go to jump school, because I didn't think I'd get jump school because of my glasses, and I did because of my 5th Ranger Battalion discharge. And I said, okay, this guy was in the 5th Ranger Battalion, can jump. So I went to jump school, and then they sent me on up to Fort Bragg, and I spent all 3 years at Fort Bragg, jock dropping, playing soldier a little bit. But they found out very quickly that when it came to playing soldier, I had no problem. I played soldier. You know. Mm-hmm. I could do anything they wanted with that 57 recoil rifle. In fact, the first round of fired was about to hit the target right in the middle, you know. So they weren't worried that if they needed me on a recoilless rifle, they had one. And they knew I could carry the damn thing. I went out on a problem one time and carried it all night long.
Did a lot of guys who were in World War II re-enlist then after the war?
Oh, yeah, there were a few of us. Yeah. In fact, there were. Boy, they were letting so many out that the Army was in trouble. The Army was getting too small. And they were glad to see us come back.
Then let's talk about Korea.
All right. I got out of the Army in December of 50, I think, 49. December of 49. And I went home. And by then, Dad had bought a farm. and Dick was running a farm for him. Dad took that at town job. And I helped Dick on the farm for a long time. And then some father in Red Wing had a son in San Francisco and had a car in Red Wing, and he wanted to get the car to the son. And he was going to pay me $75 and expenses, gas, etc., to get that car to his son in San Francisco. So I said, fine. I got in the car and I drove all the way to San Francisco and gave him the son. And I got a job in San Francisco, and it wasn't much of a job. It was a crappy job. And anyway, Korea started. So I went down to the recruiting office, and I went to the Army one first, and I said, here's my discharges. I said, I just got out of the 82nd. I'm a jumper. I'm qualified. And I hear that there's a regiment of the 17th coming through town. I said, can I sign up here and then join them when they come through town? He said, no, we can't do that kind of thing. I said, okay. And I went down the block, and there was a Navy recruiter, and I went in, and I said, okay, I got 6 years in the Army. I went to boot camp. The guy looked at me and says, 3 weeks. And I said, okay, and I went across the hall, and there's a Marine that said the same thing, and the guy says, 13 weeks. And I said, whoops, and I turned right around and went in the Navy, and I signed up in the Navy. And I was in the Navy, and they put me on a train, and we went down to San Diego, and the first thing they did, we got off the train and put us in the barracks, and got the haircut right away first, boom. And then we're going through a line drawing uniforms, and there we are in skivvy drawers going down this long line, and the pile is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And down at the end, sitting on a stool, is this lieutenant commander, and he's watching us come by, and as I come down the line, he looks at me, he says, you ever play football? I said, oh, yeah. He said, who'd you play for? I said, I don't know, St. Thomas, Fort Bragg. Oh, yeah? You want to play for us here? He said, sure. He said, okay. At the Naval Training Center in San Diego, I became a member of the football team, which took me out of boot camp. I didn't have any boot camp. So, okay, I did that. And the football season ended, and they had promised me at the end of the season, my scores were so good on the test that they took, that I could have any school in the Navy that I qualified for, whatever. So I spent the whole time. I spent the whole time working in the physical training department. And I get over there, and I put on one of those T-shirts that are blue on one side and yellow on the other, and a pair of shorts and some sneaks. And we'd get up on a platform in front of a whole company full of recruits. And the guy would say, okay, we're going to do this exercise. And there were two of us to demonstrate what the exercise is, from a platform. And that was my day job. And then the afternoon, I'd go practice football all the time. And the season ended, and then he said, well, all right. In the meantime, everybody else wearing a uniform like I've got, this is a chief or a first class. They are the ones that run the show. See, I'm the only seaman in the whole. And all these chiefs in first class are getting a big kick out of it, because I'm doing the job for them. And I get to pick their brain during the whole fall season about what do I want to strike for, what school do I want to go. And at the end, I decide I'm going to go to Corps school. I like the guy who is the corpsman, and I'm going to go to Corps school. I said, you got it. So I'm all set to go to Corps school, and the basketball coach comes by and says, play some basketball. I said, well, all right. And I went out, stayed out for a week or two, and I said, no, I'm not going to get caught up with three more years of this crap. I'm going to go to school, and I'm going to become a sailor. So I quit, and there was another guy with me who'd been a basketball player at Mississippi State, who was a center also, and he quit too, and we both went to Corps school. Up in San Diego. And after we got through with Corps school, and because of all the time I had in the Army, I was the commander of our training company. I was just like they were, but I could give close order drill. I could march them to lunch, that kind of crap. So I was doing that. And I remember after I got in the hospital, and I was one of the guys that was a patient says, I know you. You're the guy that he remembered my voice from close order drill, taking taking my company to breakfast and lunch. But anyway, we got to chorus school, and there were 8 or 9 girls, waves, who were also studying to be corpsmen. And we graduated, and they sent a whole bunch of us, I don't know how many, a bunch of us up to Bremerton to do our 6 months of hospital work to get us used to being corpsmen, you know. So, okay, I went up there, and I was working in the, because of my size again, I was working in the orthopedic ward where I could lift people and do things. But eventually what I ended up doing, I ended up volunteering for and getting night duty in the emergency room. And I did that for almost all of the 6 months. And it, man, it was a good duty. I had a couple of young guys doing their internship who are now officers in the Navy. One of them's up in Duluth. I still see him from time to time. And he'd teach me all kinds of things. Like, for instance, one night we were working, and he had the duty. Now, I had to be at the desk. But his duty was just to be present, you know. So we had a room down there with a bed. That's where he stayed. But they came in, and they were in a car, and the car had rolled over on a cliff down. And the guys had rolled out, and they were a mess. Three of them were a mess. They were so bad that one of them was an X-ray, and then the other two were on a table in the emergency room, and the doctor was doing stitching on the head, doing all the, and I was doing everything on the body, and he had taught me how to suture by practicing on an orange. You can imagine that. You know, he'd make a knife slice in an orange skin, and he'd say, okay, teach me how to suture, you know. So we spent the whole night rotating those three guys around, you know. I did all the suturing below the neck, he did all the suturing above the neck, and then the X-ray had the rest of them. And we're working, doing a good job. And I'm learning all kinds of things. He's teaching me like mad. And anyway, another one we had, an old retired chief who still had hospital privileges had gotten a fight with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend had taken a knife and stabbed him right down through here. And we got him, and he had a pocket of blood under here. We saved him. And what we're trying to do, that we didn't try, but somebody up in the office, somebody important in the Navy, came down and wanted him to press charges against the girl. No, he wouldn't. So we got him. About a week later, he came down, and he's all patched up. And he says, "Thank you." Went home. Went home to the same girl. Anyway, after that, 6 months it came time, we were to be assigned different jobs around the Navy. And some of the jobs, you know, you get jobs on tin cans or boats, or there were other first aid stations all over the place that were looking for corpsmen. But one of the jobs was corpsman for the Marines, you know, Fleet Marine Force. So I said, well, all right, I've got 6 years in the infantry, some pretty good infantry, too. What can the Marines do? That, you know, big deal. I didn't do anything they can do. So I went up and I volunteered. And the guy who was in charge of that office, I still hear from him from time to time. He's out in San Diego now.
Harry, hold on.
Yeah, you might be shorting it.
Yeah.
I'm just tying knots in it.
Don't do that.
I volunteered for the FMF. And most of the guys were so glad, because they didn't want to. It was not the place you wanted to be assigned, you know.
Now, what was that?
Fleet Marines, the bunch of us that are corpsmen for the Marines, you know. But I thought, well, what the heck? They can't do anything I haven't done. You know, big deal. So I got it, and they sent me down to Camp Lejeune,
North Carolina. Is that North Carolina?
Yeah, along that, not the Oceanside. What's the one in Oceanside? Pendleton.
Okay.
Camp Pendleton in North in California. Send us down to Pendleton and to train us to be corpsmen for the Marines. And what we had is a whole company of white hats and a bunch of doctors, dentists, and chaplains, you know. And of course, they treated all of us white hats in one way, all the others in another way. Did I tell you the story about the second day we were there? We were still in our blue uniforms, and the doctors were in back in their khakis. And the guy sitting next to me is a first class, and he's wearing a Korean ribbon. And I'm looking at him, what the hell are you going back for? You've already been there. He says, it's good duty. He says, first class, good duty, you know. I said, okay, we're talking. And the captain, who's giving us the gung-ho speech on the Marines, saw Spectre. And he said, you back there, you got something so important to say. By the way, we were three rows back in the auditorium. And right behind us, the fourth row, were all doctors and stuff. All the officers behind us. And he said, you got so much it's important to say, why don't you tell all of us? And, you know, you give it the old who's he talking to thing, you know. And I said, are you speaking to me, sir? And I stood up. He said, yes. He says, what do you got to say to your partner there that's so important? I said, well, I'm just telling him. When I joined the Navy, I almost joined the Marines. And he should have known better. But he said, well, why didn't you? And I said, well, things are going all right. And then they found out my mother and father were married. And the doctors are going, haw, 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 haw. And everybody in the eye is going nuts. And all the guys in the white hats are just staring at me. You know, this guy, you know. And standing in the corner of the stage over there is a sergeant who's going to train us. And so we're trained. So that first week, he's doing whatever he can with me. And the second, well, the day after this, might have been later on in that same day, I don't know, we were up in a clothing line, and they didn't have enough stuff my size. So they told me, well, we're going to have to send you back to the Navy. We haven't got anything to fit you. And I didn't know you're not. You send out and get stuff to fit me. I'm here now. So they did. And on that first Saturday, we're standing there for inspection, all lined up. And, of course, the white hats barely know how to get into formation. You know, I didn't have any problem. I'd been doing it all my life, you know. And I had a rifle. And being my size, I was the first guy in the front rank. And this little second lieutenant from the Marine came by, and he made a move for my weapon. Now, it stands that if you're standing at attention and you're presenting your weapon, when they touch it, you're supposed to be out of it. When they touch it, it's supposed to be free. Because if you're not, boy, they're going to rip it away from you, spin it around and wrap your knees and do all kinds of things. Well, I'm used to that. I know that kind of stuff. And I got my own little tricks. What I did, I got my thumb locked into the trigger guard, you know, so that when he makes his move, I'm not only free of it, my thumb is throwing it at the ground. You know? He does. He makes his move.
No room here, but...
Oh, let us make room.
I won't need too much. I don't think.
Hang on.
The rifle...
Okay.
...comes out and it bounces on the deck. He doesn't catch it. Mm-hmm. And it's lying there across my feet.
No.
Ooh, you guys go first.
Maybe we should stop.
Maybe we'll just... Take a break. We'll take a break here.
All right.